As the Senate now enters its third week of debate on restructuring health care, abortion remains one of the key unresolved issues. Senators who want the bill to include a strict ban on federal abortion funding like to point to the so-called Hyde Amendment as an ironclad precedent that dates back three decades. But as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, the language in that amendment has changed multiple times over the years.
During the very first day of debate on the Senate floor last month, Utah Republican Orrin Hatch explained what the Hyde Amendment, named for the late Illinois Congressman Henry Hyde, actually does.
Today's Hyde language, which has been in every annual labor HHS appropriations bill since 1976, specifically prohibits federal dollars being used to pay for abortions except if the pregnancy was a result of rape, incest, or the life of the mother is in danger.
That's true, and Congress has to approve it every single year. By contrast, Kansas Republican Sam Brownback, another abortion opponent, claimed the language in the proposed Senate health bill doesn't do enough to block federal abortion funding. That is, it's not close enough to Hyde. Instead, Brownback says the proposed Senate bill
is a departure, huge departure, 30 years, bipartisan federal policy prohibiting federal tax dollars from paying for elective abortions.
Now, the extent to which the proposed Senate health bill does or does not allow federal funding of abortion remains a matter of interpretation and argument, but the history of the Hyde Amendment is very clear. Despite suggestions to the contrary, it has been anything but written in stone all these years. Former Minnesota Republican Congressman Vin Weber served on the Appropriations Committee for most of the 1980s and early 1990s. He says abortion funding was a constant and recurring battle.
And it went back and forth depending on whether or not you had Republicans or Democrats in power in the White House.
And over those years, while the Hyde Amendment has always been renewed by Congress each year, it hasn't always been in the same form. It's been strengthened and weakened depending on the state of the abortion debate in the country.
When the Hyde Amendment was first passed in 1976, there were no exceptions, so it was just a straight-out ban.
Lori Rubner is vice president for public policy at Planned Parenthood and worked on Capitol Hill through many years of abortion fights, including some of the changes to the Hyde language.
Eventually, they added exceptions for rape, incest, to save the life of the mother, and originally including serious health when a woman had a very serious health condition. Then they took the serious health condition away.
By the mid-1980s, with President Reagan in the White House, Republicans in control of the Senate, and anti-abortion forces at a high point in their power, abortion restrictions in federal law spread, said Weber.
Well, the basic intent of Henry Hyde was to simply prohibit the use of federal funds to pay for abortions. And he had majority support for that. But when you actually get into the implementation of the policy, you find that there are a lot of other questions that people raise. Should we pay for counseling services that lead to abortion? Should you pay for abortions in the cases of rape and incest?
In 1989, the then all-Democratic House and Senate tried to add back rape and incest exceptions to the Hyde Amendment, but it was vetoed by the first President Bush, and there weren't enough votes to override. Everything changed when Bill Clinton became president in 1993. At that point, abortion rights supporters had the upper hand because Democrats also controlled both the House and Senate. They almost got rid of the Hyde Amendment entirely. Congressman Hyde himself managed to keep his amendment part of the law, but he was forced to put back the rape and incest exceptions he'd kept out for more than a decade. 2 years later, however, even with President Clinton still in office, Republicans took over the Congress, and they soon forced the president to accept new abortion restrictions, precisely because they were part of bigger spending bills the president felt he couldn't veto. Rubner says that's part of the problem with abortion always being part of annual spending bills.
So sometimes, either on the good or bad side, presidents are forced to sign either one that's more or less restrictive because they need to get these departments funded.
Not having to fight the battle every year is a key reason abortion opponents are so eager to get the Hyde restrictions permanently written into the health overhaul, and why abortion rights forces are so eager to prevent that from happening. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Most states say they're complying with the No Child Left Behind Act, or at least close. Its requirements for teachers seem pretty simple. A teacher must have a college degree, a license to teach, and be competent in the subject. In the next few minutes, we'll visit a school that illustrates why it's not so simple. It's in rural North Carolina, which says 98% of its teachers are licensed and qualified, but that still leaves the question of whether those teachers are effective. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Few people in the state of North Carolina understand the impact that poor quality teachers have on children better than Howard Manning Jr.
I call it academic genocide.
Manning, a superior court judge in Wake County, was appointed 4 years ago to enforce a court order requiring failing school districts to raise their test scores and improve the quality of instruction.
When you have 7 out of 10 children in the 8th grade below grade level in reading and math, that's terrible.
Manning is referring to the latest results from Halifax County, an impoverished rural school district a few miles from the North Carolina-Virginia border. Only 6 out of 10 students in Halifax graduate from high school, and those who do are ill-prepared for college or work. The problem, says Manning, boils down to two things: school administrators who don't believe their students can learn, and teachers who cannot teach.
It's an abomination, and that's why I've been pushing since 2005, starting with the high schools, to get these places cleaned up.
That, says Philip Rountree, is his job.
Let's go. Let's be moving. My sidewalks need to be cleaned. Let's go.
Rountree is the principal at one of 2 high schools in Halifax County, Northwest High, where he arrived with a reputation for turning around failing schools. He's convinced these kids are better behaved and working harder since he took over 2 years ago, in part because he imposed a tougher code of conduct, got parents involved, and for the first time in memory, made sure every teacher at Northwest High has a college degree and a state license.
They have gotten the certification for the areas that they're teaching in, and they have passed all the required tests. They are qualified. They had a clear license.
Now, this is no small feat, says Rountree, because it's so hard for poor, isolated rural communities like Halifax County to attract and keep good teachers. But once you have them, does a license or passing a test guarantee you're a good teacher?
I'm so glad you asked that. No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Rountree points to his own teacher's license, framed on a wall next to his college diploma and several certificates.
I went through the dog and pony show. I've got my stuff on the wall. But that doesn't make me effective. The effectiveness comes from here, right here in the heart. This doesn't mean a hill of beans.
Rebecca Garland begs to differ. She oversees teacher licensing in North Carolina and says a license means the state doesn't just let anybody teach.
We are not supposed to hire people that don't have minimum credentials.
In North Carolina, as in most states, Garland says, the licensing process makes sure applicants meet the minimum basic skills and qualifications necessary to work as a teacher. But North Carolina has gone further. It's now requiring that teachers not just be licensed, but that they show their students are learning.
Student performance on assessments must be a major component in determining which teachers are effective.
Test scores are now a huge consideration both in evaluating North Carolina teachers and deciding whether their licenses should be renewed every 3 years.
For me, being a good teacher goes far beyond test scores.
That's Andre Stewart, chair of the Social Studies Department at Northwest Halifax High, as well as the football and baseball coach. Yes, by all accounts, the coach is one of the school's most effective teachers.
I have a passion for what I do. I want to be here. Now, what I'm aiming for is to try to get my children to be able to think.
All right, so we have the budget with $400 a month. So can I go at maybe $75 a month for clothes?
No!
Unlike kids in other classrooms we visited, students in Stewart's 10th grade economics class were not asleep, disruptive, or copying something out of a textbook for the entire period.
Some people would walk through my door and they would think this is utter chaos. What some term chaos, I term engagement.
Stewart says engaging students is the only way a teacher even has a shot at motivating them to learn, work hard, and do well on standardized tests, which is what Stewart has done all 3 years he's taught at Northwest High, raised his students' test scores. As far as the state is concerned, that makes Stewart an effective teacher.
Unfortunately for us in the teaching profession, we don't know whether you're good at it until you actually get into it.
Stewart is the kind of teacher that Judge Howard Manning Jr. would love to see more of in Halifax County. Manning can't understand why it's so hard to find good teachers and turn schools around. But that's what they have to do, he says.
And then if they don't, then I have the authority to come in with a big fat baseball bat and whack them on the head. But I have to give them the chance to do it first.
Judge Manning concedes, though, it'll be years before North Carolina can truly claim that all its teachers are capable of providing students the quality education they deserve. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Sitting in for Steve Inskeep, I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. President Obama meets today with leaders of America's biggest banks, and he may have some sharp words for them. Over the weekend, the president expressed exasperation with bankers on Wall Street.
I did not run for office to be helping out a bunch of fat cat bankers on Wall Street.
Mr. Obama was speaking on the CBS program 60 Minutes. Members of his administration were also on the airwaves yesterday. And joining us now, as she does most Mondays, is NPR News analyst Cokie Roberts. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Yeah, the bank bailout seemed to be winding down. Why is the president focusing on the financial institutions right now and so sort of vigorously?
I think there are a bunch of reasons. First of all, it's year-end bonus time for the banks, and the bankers are still getting these great, big, enormous bonuses that make everybody mad. And the president says the banks don't get it, that the American people are furious with them. And the president also needs a little shoring up with his own liberal base after his decision to add more troops to Afghanistan and the continued economic bad times. So going after the banks is a good way to sort of rev up his populist supporters. The president also wants to put spotlight on the fact that these banks are spending money lobbying Congress against new regulation, and he wants the Senate to follow through on the financial services regulatory bill that the House passed late on Friday, although Senate action on that is likely to be a long time coming.
And Cokie, given that he referred to bankers generally as fat cats last night, what are the bankers he's going to talk to today likely to hear?
I don't know if he's going to serve them food, but when she answered that question on NBC yesterday, Council of Economic Advisors Chairman Christina Romer kept using the word responsible, that the banks need to be responsible in lending more to small business, that's key in terms of job creation. They have to find ways to keep responsible homeowners in their homes. But she's also talking about the way people on Wall Street are compensated, and she says that would lead to irresponsible risk-taking. Basically, the administration's still frustrated that money's not moving through the system, that credit isn't out there. And that's, of course, what the bailout was all about.
And then out there talking yesterday, the president's economic advisors couldn't seem to agree on whether the recession is over.
Really over. Economic Council Chair Lawrence Summers said everyone agrees the recession is over, and he predicted job growth will start next spring. But apparently he hadn't heard Ms. Romer, who, when asked that question, is it over, said, of course not. She was making the point that whatever the technical definition is, it isn't really a recovery until people get back to work. And she was trying to make the point that it's still a crisis situation. It's not time to start pulling back on new jobs programs, which the administration hopes to push in Congress, or to pull in the face of the huge federal deficit, which Republicans are talking a lot about.
And then the Senate yesterday voted to add to those deficits. It passed a bill aimed at keeping many government departments in operation for another year. I guess an important bill. But what's the likely effect of that vote?
Well, there was a lot of Republicans saying, you know, here's the deficit spending happening all over again. But there isn't a lot of choice about keeping government in operation, though there were a lot of pet projects in those bills. But, you know, the fact that the Senate voted on it Sunday afternoon tells you something, Renee. They're getting very cranky. They've been in session 14 straight days. Harry Reid is trying to wear them down, so they'll basically say uncle and vote for the health care bill. And usually that's a pretty good strategy. The Senate usually does get things done by exhaustion, but sometimes they get so cranky they dig in, and that can be a problem.
NPR News analyst Cokie Roberts.
As Reverend Jackson just mentioned, in the president's Nobel acceptance speech, he explored just war theory, a concept that's been debated and mulled over by Cicero, Aquinas, Augustine, John Locke, and in our own time, Michael Walzer. The earliest humans, the president explained, waged war because it was seen as a natural part of life, like floods and famine. But over time, the idea of what war meant changed. Here's an excerpt from the president.
The concept of a just war emerged, suggesting that war is justified only when certain conditions were met. If it is waged as a last resort or in self-defense, if the force used is proportional, and if, whenever possible, civilians are spared from violence.
But judging by these criteria, which wars now are just? Well, one of the seminal works on these questions is Michael Walzer's 1977 book, Just and Unjust Wars. Michael Walzer is a professor emeritus at the Institute for Advanced Study, and he joins me from his home in Princeton. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, Michael Walzer, this past week in his Nobel Prize speech, the president spoke at length about the moral justifications for war. Is Afghanistan, in your view, a just war?
Well, it was a just war when we started. We had good reasons for thinking that the people who attacked us on 9/11 had prepared the attack, not only in Afghanistan, but in close partnership with the government of Afghanistan. And that, I think, justified a decision. But then, in my view, the Bush people did just about everything wrong. President Obama inherited a mess in Afghanistan.
You have written that in Afghanistan, whether it is a just war any longer, the United States has to remain there because it has an obligation to the Afghan people. What do you mean by that?
Well, you can't invade a country and overthrow its government and fight inside its borders for 8 years without incurring responsibilities to all of the people who cooperated with you, to all of the people who came out of hiding as Democrats or trade unionists or feminists or educators of girls. All of those people would be at risk for their lives, if we just wiped our hands and walked away.
Michael Walzer, if the Bush doctrine was about preemptive action, you know, that you don't wait to be attacked in order to take military action, is the Obama doctrine emerging as one based on ideas that you outlined in your book, Just and Unjust Wars, as sort of a doctrine based on the just war theory?
Well, I hope it is. I think that would be a good doctrine. But just war theory can be corrupted and distorted like any other theory. Remember how the Bulgarians under the communist regime called themselves a people's democracy. The triumph of just war theory in American political discourse doesn't mean that we can give up the critical uses of the theory. We still have to scrutinize every action of our government and regularly and continually ask, is this just?
That's political philosopher Michael Walzer. He's professor emeritus at the Institute of Advanced Study and co-editor of the quarterly magazine Dissent. His book is called Just and Unjust Wars. Michael Walzer, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. This is the week that the big names show up at the climate talks in Copenhagen, which means that there will be a big push for some sort of agreement. More than 100 heads of states will be there, including President Obama. In a few moments, we'll hear why the Pentagon, for the first time, has put climate change on its short list of threats to national security. First, we turn for an update on the negotiations in Copenhagen to NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, who's there. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Now, we've heard talk over this whole past week and sometimes some pretty heated rhetoric. What was accomplished?
Well, the first week of these talks generally has the lower-level negotiators coming in. They meet behind closed doors. And meanwhile, the higher-level people come out and they swap rhetoric. And we saw some fairly testy back and forth between China and the United States here over some of their unresolved issues, as you might expect. But that said, there was actually major progress on one important piece of this, and that's a deal that would ultimately put a dollar value on tropical forests, which means there would finally be a financial incentive for countries that have tropical forests to preserve them rather than cut them down. Conservationists have been working really hard on this for years, and it's an important element of a climate deal, but it's not clearly the main event.
Can you have a deal, though, without the really big issues? And there's a number of them. Remind us of what they are.
Yeah, and those include how much we're going to reduce carbon dioxide emissions and Countries from around the world have been stepping up and talking about how much they're planning to do. There's still a lot of back and forth about whether that's enough, but I think people are pretty clear that they've put numbers on the table and they may not budge very much from that. So another big stumbling block is whether actions in the developing world, such as China, will be part of a legally binding agreement. Countries have said they'll do things, but they haven't really said whether they will be legally binding. And the U.S. says no deal unless it really is legally binding on the international stage. So that's a big thing. Another huge issue is money, of course. Rich countries are talking about putting about $10 billion per year on the table to help poor countries adapt to climate change and so on. But it has to be much, much more than that, according to numerous studies. And, of course, developing world says we need tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars a year. So far, there's no clear idea of where all that money will come from and who will pass it out and all of the logistics of that.
And then, Richard, outside on the streets, there were protests and there were protesters arrested.
Yes, about 1,000 people were detained. Very few people were actually arrested. It was, the theater part of this meeting. It's not just diplomats hunkering down in conference rooms. It's people getting out in the streets and saying, we need a deal, we need it now. We're starting to attract some of the star power. For example, yesterday, former Archbishop Desmond Tutu came and spoke, and Al Gore is going to be in town and so on. So there's a celebrity element to this as well.
Back to the question of a deal. If the negotiators there don't reach an agreement this week, even when the honchos come in, the heads of state, what then?
I think that they have to come away with something. Otherwise, it's going to be just an enormous global embarrassment. Many people say President Obama and China's premier wouldn't come if they didn't believe that they had a deal in their back pocket. But they've already agreed that this is going to be a political deal, not a legally binding treaty, and they've already talking about meeting next year. So they can leave a lot of issues up in the air and still declare success here without even actually reaching total agreement.
Thank you very much. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris is covering the climate talks in Copenhagen.
Thanks, Renee.
A different sort of battle captivated millions of young movie fans this year, one that pitted vampires against werewolves. That's a scene from the Twilight saga, New Moon. It came at the tail end of a decade filled with big-time sagas, franchises, sequels, and remakes. In the next part of All Things Considered, I'll talk with movie critic Bob Mondello about Hollywood's insistence on bringing back characters over and over again. Stay with us.
Bella!
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com. From Cabot Creamery Cooperative, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar cheese, and offering recipes, stories, and programs for schools at cabotcheese.coop. And from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Medicare open enrollment ends December 31st. More at medicare.gov or 1-800-MEDICARE. This is NPR.
Beverly Sylvia was sure she was having a stroke at age 49. When she reached the hospital, everything depended on a diagnosis by video with a doctor 75 miles away.
Can you ask her how old she is?
Yeah,
she's trying.
I could understand everything he was saying, but it just was not coming out of my mouth.
I'm Steve Inskeep, Long Distance Life-Saving, on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Craig Windham with these headlines. White House Economic Advisor Lawrence Summers says putting Americans back to work remains the administration's main domestic priority. Summers predicts the economy will begin creating more jobs next spring. Once the job market is stabilized, he says, the White House will start tackling the growing federal deficit. An Interior Ministry official in Iraq says 13 suspected insurgents are in custody in connection with last week's deadly bombings in Baghdad. The suspects are accused of helping plan the bombing attacks that killed at least 127 people. Global consulting firm Accenture is ending its sponsorship agreement with golfer Tiger Woods, the first company to cut ties with him altogether after his admission of marital infidelity. In a statement, the company said Woods no longer is the right representative for the firm. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Now, last week, Bob Mondello and I started a look back at the film world over the past decade. And this week, it's Mondello Part 2.
I'll be back.
Oh, I know you did send me back to the future, but I'm back. I'm back from the future.
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
Bob, you are officially a sequel now.
Apparently, I'll be back. I like that.
That's Bob Mondello, our film critic, of course. And today, Bob is here to talk about films from the past decade with twos and threes and even sixes attached to them. It seemed like, Bob, there were a lot of sequels over the past decade, or does it just feel that way?
No, there have been a lot. I guess there are always a lot, but it feels like they got big. They really just got big.
Now, but I mean, these are nothing new. You've had James Bond and Star Wars and Indiana Jones.
Sure, and Buck Rogers, if you go all the way back. I mean, this is how Hollywood decided to hook people on the movies in the first place. They used to do these serials, right? And that's the whole notion of a sequel is sort of like that. You do the story and then you do it again and then you extend it and you extend it a little bit more. This decade, I think what's happened to sequels is they've gotten all literary. And it's kind of interesting to me that you've got the two wizard franchises.
Oh, yes.
Lord of the Rings and the Harry Potter movies. And then you've got the vampire franchise now.
Twilight series. Yeah.
And let's play a clip from one. The one that won pretty much everything, both the box office and then also the Oscar nominations. It got nominated all three times. And actually it won for the third one, The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King.
Now come the days of the king.
This day does not belong to one man, but to all. Let us together rebuild this world, that we may share in the days of peace.
And then, of course, there's another kind of literary adaptation, the novels of the sort that we now call graphic. Back when I was a kid, they were called comic books.
Yes. The graphic novel.
The
Bob.
Graphic novel.
Please, please.
I guess the example of that that's been big has been Spider-Man. Let's listen for a second to Spider-Man 2, after Peter Parker has tried to retire his alter ego.
You take Spider-Man's pictures, right?
I used to.
Where is he?
He quit.
He'll be back, right?
I don't know.
Oh, he'll be back, Bob. Over and over again.
I will always be Spider-Man.
That essentially is what sequels are. They keep on coming back. They are now franchises, okay? When film companies decide to do this, they build a franchise around something. If you buy all of the Harry Potter books, you know you're going to have seven of these, right? And so you can extend the franchise for all of that.
I mean, it seems obvious, though. I mean, an ailing movie industry is going to keep making sequels when they know they've got a winner, right? I mean, they know people are going to go see them, so
sure.
They're going to make them.
Yeah, well, that's a logic. It seems to me that two things happen when you make sequels. One is that the second one and the third one and the fourth one, each of them has to escalate a little bit. So the star gets more expensive because he's been in the thing. He becomes essential to the thing. And then all the special effects budgets have to go up. And the other thing it seems to me that happens is that you're training an audience to see pictures in a certain kind of way. Not to get too highfalutin about this, but the Greeks thought that there was a certain way that a drama was told, right? You had rising action to a climax and then falling action to a conclusion. Well, basically what Hollywood does is it cuts off the conclusion. So you get this rising action to a climax, you stop, and then you're set up for the sequel. And what happens then is that you keep on getting these stories that are all beginning and middle. And you never get an end. And we've trained audiences not to expect an ending. When people die, it's a surprise, right? Because they can't come back.
Well, I'm looking forward to Euripides Part 2.
yeah.
In the clip we heard earlier on from The Lord of the Rings, where he says at the end, we may share in the days of peace. I mean, that sounds like it is over, that it is finished.
Good point. And it actually was. That was one of the eight endings they did to that movie because they had to convince the audience that it was actually over. And you know what's hysterical is? It isn't really over. They're going to do a Hobbit movie, right? The other novel that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote. I mean, basically, they just keep on going with these things.
That's Bob Mondello. He reviews films for this program, and throughout the month, he'll be reviewing The Decade Gone By. Bob, we will see you sequel part four next week.
Absolutely. Part three, I think.
And we'd like to hear from you as well. What were your favorite sequels from the past 10 years? Join the discussion at npr.org.